All right, so ready to dive into the wild world of externalities?
I am. Always a fascinating topic.
For sure. I mean, it's one of those things, right? Like, we kind of get it, but then also not really. At least I don't.
Yeah, it can be a little tricky.
It can. So let's break it down. We're going to use the steel industry as a case study, and our trusty guide is EC140, Chapter 10. The goal today is to really understand how these hidden costs and benefits, these externalities, shape our world.
And why they matter so much. Because they really do.
Okay, so first things first, what exactly is an externality?
At its core, an externality is anytime someone's decision impacts someone else who, well, had no say in that decision.
Okay, that makes sense. So, like, the classic example is pollution,
Right.
right?
Like, think of a steel mill pumping out smoke.
Yeah, totally. The people living nearby, they're breathing that in, dealing with the consequences.
Exactly. They're bearing the cost of that pollution, even though they didn't buy or sell any
It's
steel.
like a hidden cost shifted onto them.
Exactly. And that's what makes externalities so interesting. They show us that what we see in the market, the price of something, doesn't always reflect the true cost.
Okay, so let's visualize this. The textbook has a couple of figures to help. Figure one, I think.
Right. So this figure shows what happens in a market without externalities. You have your supply curve representing the cost to producers.
Like how much it costs to make that steel.
Right. And the demand curve, which shows the value to buyers.
How much people are willing to pay for it.
Yeah. And where those two meet, that's the market equilibrium. It tells us how much steel gets produced and sold at a certain price.
Econ 101 stuff, supply and demand.
Exactly. But now, flip over to figure two. This one adds in the externality.
The pollution from the steel mill,
Right. And it introduces this idea of social cost.
which is what the total cost to society, not just the producers.
Exactly. You see that social cost curve? It's higher than the regular supply curve because it includes those external costs, the pollution.
So the real cost of steel is actually higher than what the market shows.
Exactly. And that leads to this gap, right, between how much steel the market wants us to produce, what they call Q market, and how much would actually be best for society as a whole, Q optimum.
Because we're not factoring in those extra costs, so we're overproducing.
Yeah. Which brings us to the big question. How do we fix this? We can't just shut down all the steel mills.
Right, steel is important.
Yeah.
So, what are our options?
Well, the textbook lays out two main approaches: command and control policies, and then there are the market-based policies.
Command and control. That sounds kind of intense.
It's pretty straightforward. The government basically sets limits and regulations.
So, like the EPA telling factories how much they can pollute.
Exactly. It's a direct way to curb pollution, but it can be inflexible.
Because it treats all polluters the same,
Yeah.
even if some might be better at reducing emissions than others.
Right. And it might not be the most cost-effective approach.
Okay, so what about market-based policies? What's the thinking there?
Market-based policies, they're more about incentives. We're trying to make it in the polluter's own best interest to clean up their act.
Okay, I like that. So how do we do that?
The two big tools here are corrective taxes and tradable pollution permits.
I think I've heard of corrective taxes. It's basically make the polluters pay for the damage, right?
Exactly. You put a price on pollution, and suddenly it's in their best interest to find ways to reduce it. It's like that old saying, if you want less of something, tax it.
I mean, it makes sense, but does it actually work?
It can. Take a look at figure four. This shows how a corrective tax shifts that supply curve upwards. Ideally, it aligns it with that social cost curve we talked about.
So it helps us get closer to that optimal quantity instead of the market quantity.
Exactly. It's like we're using the market itself to correct for its own shortcomings.
I like that. Using the system to fix the system.
Right. And the textbook, it uses this example of a paper mill and a steel mill, both polluting a river. A corrective tax encourages them to figure out the cheapest way to reduce that pollution.
Which is better than just slapping a blanket regulation on everyone.
Exactly. And then there's the other market-based approach, tradable pollution permits.
Okay, this is the one I'm a little fuzzy on. How does that work?
So imagine the government sets a limit on the total amount of pollution allowed. But instead of telling each company exactly how much they can pollute, they create these permits.
Permits to pollute.
Exactly. And companies can buy and sell these permits amongst themselves.
So it's literally a market for pollution.
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah.
It creates a price for pollution, and companies can decide, is it cheaper to reduce our emissions or to just buy a permit from someone else?
So the permits end up in the hands of the companies who value them the most, the ones who would find it really expensive to reduce their own pollution.
Precisely. It creates this incentive to innovate, to find ways to pollute less. And it's been successful. The textbook highlights the sulfur dioxide trading program, which significantly reduced acid rain in the U.S.
That's amazing. So we've got command and control, taxes, permits, lots of tools to address these externalities. But are there ever times when the government, you know, isn't the best solution?
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes private solutions can be surprisingly effective.
Like what?
Think about social norms, like, you know, not littering.
Right. We just kind of know that's not cool.
Exactly. Or charities stepping in to provide public goods, things the market might not produce enough of.
Okay, that makes sense. But the textbook also mentioned this thing called the Coase theorem.
Ah, the Coase theorem. It basically suggests that if people can negotiate easily, they can often sort these things out themselves.
Regardless of who has the right to pollute or whatever.
Right. It uses this example, Emily and her barking dog, Clifford. Emily's neighbor, Horace, is not a fan of Clifford's enthusiasm.
I can relate. My neighbor's dog.
Right. So the Coase theorem says if Emily and Horace can talk it out without too much hassle.
Without lawyer fees and all that.
Right. Then they can reach a solution that works for both of them. Maybe Emily pays Horace to put up with the barking, or maybe she invests in some dog training.
Okay, so private bargaining can work, but I imagine it gets a lot harder when more people are involved.
Definitely. If it was a factory polluting a lake used by hundreds of people,
getting everyone to agree on a solution would be a nightmare.
Exactly. So the Coase theorem, it has its limits. But it does highlight that sometimes the best solutions come from dialogue and compromise, not just top-down rules.
So it's a mix. Sometimes government intervention is necessary. Sometimes we can solve things ourselves.
It's about finding the right balance. And honestly, that's what makes this whole discussion of externalities so interesting. It forces us to think about how interconnected we are, how our choices impact others.
For sure. And it reminds us that, you know, economics isn't just about numbers and graphs. It's about people. And choices and consequences.
Couldn't have said it better myself. So, you know, we've been talking about these hidden costs, these negative externalities. But what about the flip side? Those hidden benefits.
The positive externalities. Yeah, those are important too.
They are. And the textbook uses technology as a really interesting example here. Specifically, these technology spillovers.
Technology spillovers.
It's the idea that one company's innovation can benefit other companies, even companies in totally different industries.
Okay, I think I'm following. So like one company invents something new and that knowledge, those benefits kind of spill over into the rest of the economy.
Exactly. It's like imagine a company designs a super efficient industrial robot.
Okay, yeah, picture that. Super efficient robot.
Right, so that robot, it helps that company, of course.
Yeah.
But the design, the technology behind it, that could inspire other companies to improve their robots.
So it sparks more innovation across the board.
Right. And maybe it even leads to like entirely new uses for robots that no one had even thought of before.
So one company's breakthrough leads to a whole wave of progress.
Exactly. And some economists argue that the government should actually step in and encourage this.
How so?
Well, they say things like, maybe we should subsidize industries where these technology spillovers are likely to be really big.
Okay, so give them a little financial boost to innovate, knowing that the benefits will spread beyond just that one company.
Precisely. But of course, there's always debate about whether the government can actually pick the right industries.
Right. Like, what if they end up supporting the next Betamax, a technology that just doesn't take off?
Exactly. That's the risk with any kind of industrial policy.
So are there other ways to encourage these positive spillovers without, you know, having the government play a venture capitalist?
Well, the textbook points to patents.
Patents. How do those fit in?
So a patent gives an inventor exclusive rights to their invention for a certain period of time.
Right. So they have a monopoly, at least for a while.
Yeah. But the idea is that by protecting their intellectual property, we encourage them to innovate in the first place. Because they know they'll be able to profit from their invention.
It gives them an incentive to create something new.
Exactly. And then eventually those patents expire, the knowledge becomes public, and everyone benefits.
It's like we need that initial period of exclusivity to incentivize the innovation, but ultimately we want that knowledge to spread and benefit society as a whole.
Right. It's all about striking that balance.
And that seems to be a recurring theme here, this idea of balance. Balancing individual actions with the well-being of society.
It really is. That's what makes this whole topic of externality so fascinating. It's this constant push and pull. We want people to be free to make their own choices, but we also have to acknowledge that those choices can have ripple effects.
Sometimes those ripple effects are good, like with technology spillovers, and sometimes they're bad, like with pollution.
And understanding externalities helps us figure out how to manage those ripple effects, how to make sure that we're promoting both individual freedom and collective well-being.
So it's not about, like, restricting freedom or, you know, imposing a ton of government rules.
Not necessarily. Sometimes the best solutions come from individuals and communities themselves.
Like those social norms we talked about.
Right. Or those charities that step up to fill the gaps.
It's about recognizing that we all have a role to play in creating a better world.
I like that. A role to play.
We're not just passive bystanders. We can actually make a difference.
Absolutely. And sometimes the most effective solutions aren't the big sweeping government programs. Sometimes they're the small everyday choices that we make, like choosing to bike to work instead of driving, or donating to an organization that's planting trees.
It's about being mindful of the impact of our actions, both big and small.
And that, I think, is a powerful message.
It is. It's empowering. It means that we're not powerless in the face of these challenges.
Exactly. And it all starts with understanding how interconnected we really are.
That's what these externalities show us, right? How our choices impact each other, for better or worse.
It's all connected.
I'm really glad we dug into this. It's given me a lot to think about.
Me too. It's always a good reminder that economics isn't just about, you know, money and markets. It's about people and how we interact with each other and how we can create a world that works for everyone.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the problems, pollution, traffic, all that fun stuff. But let's shift gears a bit. Let's talk about solutions.
Okay, yeah, let's get into that. What can we actually do about these externalities?
I mean, we've touched on some things already. Government regulations, taxes.
Right, those command and control policies.
Yeah.
And the market-based approaches. But the textbook also talks about some really interesting private solutions.
Okay, like what? Give me some examples.
Well, think about moral codes and social norms. Like, why do most people not litter?
Because it's, like, ingrained in us that it's wrong.
Exactly. It's not that we're all terrified of getting a fine. It's just, like, not cool to be that guy.
Right. It's that social pressure. Don't be a jerk.
Exactly. And that can be incredibly powerful. Those social sanctions, they can actually be more effective than any law.
So sometimes the solution is just, like, being a decent human being.
It sounds simple, but yeah. And then there are charities. Think about all the environmental groups out there working to protect natural resources.
Right. They step in where the market isn't doing enough.
Exactly. They're driven by a sense of social responsibility, not just profits. And they provide those public goods that everyone benefits from.
It's like they're filling the gaps, providing things that the market might not produce enough of on its own, like clean air or education.
Right. And the government can even support these private solutions, you know, through things like tax breaks for charitable donations. It's like a partnership.
I like that. It shows that we're not just stuck waiting for the government to fix everything. Individuals and communities can make a real difference.
Absolutely. And that brings us back to something we touched on earlier, the Coase Theorem.
Ah, yes. Back to Emily and Clifford.
Right. So the Coase Theorem, it suggests that if people can negotiate easily, they can often reach an efficient outcome on their own.
Even without the government stepping in?
Right. It all comes down to those transaction costs, you know, lawyer fees, time, all that. If those costs are low, then people can just sit down and hash things out.
Like Emily and her neighbor Horace could just talk it out, figure out a way to deal with Clifford's barking that works for both of them.
Exactly. But of course, things aren't always that simple. If it was a factory polluting a lake used by hundreds of people.
Yeah, getting everyone to the negotiating table, that would be a nightmare.
It would. And that's where those private solutions can start to break down. But even with its limitations, the Coase Theorem, it reminds us that sometimes the best solutions come from dialogue and compromise, not just from top-down rules.
It's about seeing things from other people's perspectives and trying to find solutions that work for everyone involved.
Exactly. It's about collaboration and empathy.
This whole conversation has been so insightful. It feels like we've really gone deep on this idea of externalities.
I'm glad you think so. It's a topic that's so relevant to so many aspects of our lives.
It really is. It makes you think about the world differently. Like suddenly you're seeing externalities everywhere.
Right. It's like you put on these special glasses and you can see all these hidden connections.
It's true. You start to realize how much our choices impact each other, how interconnected we really are.
And that's a powerful thing. Because once you start seeing those connections, you can start making more informed choices. choices that benefit not just yourself, but the people around you and the planet as a whole.
That's a great point. It's not about, you know, giving up our individual freedom. It's about understanding how that freedom is intertwined with the well-being of others.
Exactly. It's about finding that balance, that sweet spot where individual actions and collective well-being align.
This has been such a great deep dive. I feel like I've learned so much.
I'm glad to hear that. And, you know, it's funny because we're talking about economics here, but really, this is about so much more than that.
What do you mean?
I mean, externalities, they're about how we interact with each other, how we make decisions, how we share resources, how we live together on this planet.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's about the big picture.
It is. And it's a reminder that, you know, economics, it's not just some dry, abstract subject. It's about people.
Mm-hmm.
And choices and consequences and the future we're creating together.
It's about taking responsibility for our actions and working together to build a better world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It really makes you think about the bigger picture, doesn't it?
It does. And speaking of the bigger picture, there's one more thing from the textbook that I think we should touch on. It's this idea of carbon dividends.
Ah, yes. Carbon dividends. It's a fascinating proposal.
I've heard of it, but honestly, I'm a little fuzzy on the details.
Well, it's basically a way to address climate change using, you know, those market-based approaches we've been talking about.
Okay, so remind me, what are those approaches again?
We talked about corrective taxes, right?
Right, like making polluters pay for the damage they cause.
Exactly. So a carbon tax would be a classic example of that.
Mm.
You tax carbon emissions, and that incentivizes companies to find ways to reduce those emissions.
Makes sense. But where do the dividends come in?
So with a regular carbon tax, the government would usually take that revenue and, I don't know, use it to fund environmental programs or maybe reduce other taxes.
Yeah, I've heard that argument.
But with carbon dividends, the government takes that revenue from the carbon tax and gives it directly back to the public.
Wait, like everyone gets a check?
Yep, essentially. Mm. Every household gets a dividend payment funded by those carbon taxes.
Whoa, that's a pretty radical idea.
It is. But it's gaining a lot of traction.
I can see why. It sounds like it could be a win-win. You reduce emissions and you put money back in people's pockets.
Exactly. And, you know, politically speaking, it's much easier to sell than a regular carbon tax.
Mm-hmm.
People are a lot more likely to support a policy if they're getting a check out of it.
Makes sense. Plus, it addresses some of those concerns about government overreach, right? If the money is going directly back to the people, it's less likely to be wasted or misused.
Right. It's like, we're using the market to fix the market's own shortcomings.
Love that. It's such an elegant solution.
It really is. And, you know, it's just one example of how we can apply these economic principles to tackle some of the biggest challenges we face.
It gives me hope. It shows that we can find solutions that are both effective and equitable.
Exactly. And that's what this whole deep dive has been about, hasn't it? Understanding how our choices impact each other and figuring out how to create a world that works for everyone.
It has. And honestly, I feel so much more informed now. Like, I can actually go out and have these conversations, make more informed decisions.
That's great to hear. Knowledge is power, as they say.
It really is. And I want to thank you, you know, for sharing your knowledge with me, with our listeners. It's been a fascinating conversation.
The pleasure was all mine. I always enjoy these deep dives.
Me too. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this journey into the world of externalities. We hope you learn something new and maybe even feel inspired to make a difference. Until next time, keep those brain gears turning.